14th. It found that 57% of U.S. voters think Trump, who entered politics in 2015 to run for president, shouldn't be allowed to seek office in the future, compared with 43% who don't support such a ban. Trump still faces a trial in the U.S. Senate after House Democrats, joined by just 10 Republicans, voted last week to impeach him for inciting the violent siege of the Capitol on January 6th with his repeated lies about the November election. Although 87% of Democratic voters want Trump barred from running for political office again, 76% of Republicans disagree. The poll also showed that voters are largely split on impeachment, with 51% calling the effort legitimate given that he provoked the Capitol attack, and 49% accusing lawmakers of playing politics. The post-Capitol riot polling on Trump is mixed, as he maintained a fairly high job approval rating in our poll, but 48% said he should be impeached versus censure or doing nothing, and a majority favored a ban on his running in the future. Mark Penn, the director of Harvard CAPS Harris poll, told The Hill. This was seen as an appropriate penalty at this point. Incoming Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on Tuesday, January 19th, made clear that restoring trust in U.S. democracy is a key priority, with Democrats set to take control of the chamber on Wednesday by the slimmest margin possible, with Kamala Harris breaking any tie voters. The Democratic leader said on the Senate floor on Tuesday, January 19th, that Trump is a threat to our constitutional order, and after what he has done, the consequences of which we were all witness to, Donald Trump should not be eligible to run for office ever again. So let me be clear. There will be an impeachment trial in the United States Senate, Schumer said. There will be a vote on convicting the president for high crimes and misdemeanors, and if the president is convicted, there will be a vote on barring him from running again. After a pair of Democrats who won runoff races in Georgia and Harris' replacement are sworn in, there will be a 50-50 split in the Senate. Two-thirds of senators would have to vote to convict Trump. Schumer is reportedly working out a power-sharing agreement with outgoing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has come under fire in recent days for not immediately reconvening after the House impeachment vote. Neither Schumer nor McConnell nor House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said when the trial will begin, but according to The Hill, the earliest one could start. If the House submits the article of impeachment afternoon, shortly after Biden is sworn in, or Thursday afternoon. McConnell, on Tuesday, January 19th, publicly accused Trump of inciting the Capitol attack for the first time, saying on the Senate floor, "The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people, and they tried to use fear and violence to stop a specific proceeding of the first branch of the federal government, which they did not like," unquote. Some progressives responded by calling out the GOP leader for delaying a trial until after Biden's inauguration, especially given that lawmakers and Trump's cabinet faced demands to remove him from office via the impeachment process or the 25th Amendment immediately after the right-wing mob stormed the Capitol. As Representative Rashida Tlaib put it, speeches aren't enough. Do your job and start impeachment trial, said Representative Ilhan Omar in response to McConnell's remarks. It's time to act beyond statements. survey results and continued pressure on Senate leaders come after a Washington Post-ABC News poll released recently showed that 54% of Americans, including one in eight Republicans, feel that Trump should be charged with the crime of inciting a riot for his speech that preceded the storming of the Capitol. Pilgrimage again.
The years of war in Syria were difficult years, a time when Syria was the source of bad news. Before the war, Syria was so peaceful that it seemed it was solely created for pilgrims to visit it and seek tranquility, a place of pilgrimage for Muslims and Christians alike. But war killed and destroyed so much of Syria that perhaps it has killed the memories of the past too, the memories held in the minds of those who had seen Syria before the war. War has ended in many Syrian cities, and this means that pilgrims can once more travel to Syria for pilgrimage. With this hope that pilgrims will once again set foot in this land, we will visit the different pilgrimage sites in Syria and see how they have survived the war. Aleppo is Syria's largest and most populated city. It is also among the oldest cities in the world that has linked the East to the West for many centuries. Aleppo is not only a city for Muslims, many Christians also live in this city. In fact, one of Aleppo's tourist attractions is the many beautiful churches in the city. Historically, Aleppo has been famous for its bustling bazaars, its textile industry, its seminaries and universities, and the Aleppo Citadel. These are all what makes Aleppo important and special, and perhaps due to its importance, terrorists tried relentlessly to fully occupy the city during the war, but they were never successful. This enduring war has left Aleppo with scars. In the city, one can find prosperous and bustling neighborhoods next to neighborhoods that have been fully destroyed. For Muslims, especially Shia Muslims, Aleppo is home to two important sites, and it was always visited whenever Muslims travel to the city, Mashhad al-Hussein and Mashhad al-Muhsin. It is said that when the Karbala caravan enters Syria from Iraq, it stayed near a church for one night. A holy father from the church noticed that there is a light shining up to the sky from Imam Hussein's decapitated head. That is why, by paying a hefty sum of money to the soldiers, he managed to borrow the Imam's head for a night. The Holy Father baptizes it and places it on an altar. This altar is now a pilgrimage site. The current building was built around Mashhad al-Hussein. Its architecture resembles that of old churches in the area. Mashhad al-Muhsin is also related to the events of Ashura. It is said that Imam Hussein's wife was pregnant, but the baby was lost after the incident of Ashura. The baby was named Muhsin and was buried in the place that later became known as Mashhad al-Muhsin. These two pilgrimage sites only stand 300 meters apart, but during the war in Aleppo, it was the border between the terrorists and the resistance. The terrorists managed to invade and occupy Mashhad al-Muhsin, but they were never able to set foot in Mashhad al-Hussein, despite all their efforts. Yet this pilgrimage site was severely destroyed by the war. After the war, Shia Muslims reconstructed the site, and now both pilgrimage sites are ready for pilgrims to arrive. In Aleppo, there is a tomb that is said to belong to Zechariah, which is located in the Great Mosque of Aleppo. This mosque was originally constructed in the first century of the Islamic calendar. During the war, the Great Mosque of Aleppo was occupied by terrorist forces, and that is how this historic monument was transformed into this ruin. With the liberation of Aleppo, the restoration of the Great Mosque of Aleppo started. This is why all the original pieces of stone were carefully recovered and meticulously recorded so that they can be put in place during the restoration project. Currently, this mosque is not open to visitors or pilgrims. But after its restoration, this mosque and the tomb will certainly be a destination for pilgrims visiting Aleppo. To see the rest of Syria's pilgrimage sites, one must travel from Aleppo towards Damascus. The first place you will come across is Adra. The tomb of Hujr ibn Adi is located in Adra. Hujr was a close companion of Prophet Muhammad and Imam Ali. He never agreed to swear allegiance to Muawiyah and continuously disclosed his corruption. And that is why Muawiyah ordered him to be killed. When Hujr was apprehended, he was given the chance to use profanity against Imam Ali in order to live, but he did not agree. Khudr, along with his son and a number of his companions, were martyred in the 51st year of the Islamic calendar. In August 2013, terrorists occupied the region and entered the mosque where the tomb of Khudr was located. They destroyed the building and desecrated the grave and claimed to have removed the corpse from its original resting place. But after the liberation of Adra, it became evident that the terrorists had only dug less than a meter deep, and since the body was buried much deeper, the terrorists never actually managed to reach it. This site was later restored by Iraqi defenders of the shrine and other Shia Muslims. This site is ready for pilgrims to visit it. On the outskirts of Damascus lies the Mosque of the Prophet Abel. It is located 45 kilometers from the capital city of Syria. This site has always attracted pilgrims to Syria. After visiting Adra and the tomb of Khudr, the caravans of pilgrims reached Damascus. Historians claim that the city of Damascus dates back to 3000 BC. It is the oldest city in the world that still stands, and people are still living in it. Damascus is just as sacred to Christians and Jews as it is to Muslims. But for Shia Muslims, Damascus is home to a few sacred sites, and one of them is the Bab el-Saghir Cemetery. It is a large cemetery in the center of Damascus that is the burial site for a number of the Prophet's companions and children of the 12 Imams. The most important of which is the tomb of Kulsum, the daughter of Imam Ali and Hazrat Zahra. Close by is the tomb of Sakina, the daughter of Imam Hussein. These two tombs are located in one chamber, and pilgrims can easily visit both. It is believed that Bab el-Saghir Cemetery is also the burial grounds of Abdullah, the son of Imam Sadiq Fatima Sughra, one of Imam Hussein's daughters, and Abdullah, the son of Imam Sajjad. The graves of nine of the Prophet's companions are also located in this cemetery, the most notable of which is Balal, the first muazzin of Islam. Another companion of the Prophet is Abdullah Ja'far Tayyar, the husband of Lady Zainab. His tomb is adjacent to that of Balal's. According to some historical documents, three of the Prophet's wives, Salameh, Habibah, and Hafsa, are also buried in this cemetery. Faize and Asma, Hazrat Zainab's maids, are also buried here too. Next to Bab el-Saghir Cemetery is a holy place which is believed to be the burial site for the heads of 16 martyrs of Karbala. They belong to Hazrat Abbas and his brothers, Ali Akbar, Imam Hussein's son, Abdullah and Qasim, the sons of Imam Hassan, Habib ibn Mazahir and Hur are among the 16 heads that have been buried here. This area is separated from the cemetery, and inside the shrine there are 16 turbans that signify the 16 heads. There are other historical narratives that say that there are only 3 heads belonging to Hazrat Abbas, Ali Akbar, and Habib ibn Mazahir buried here. Bab el-Saghir Cemetery was threatened many times by the terrorists, but with the resistance of the people and the army, it was never occupied. This cemetery remains as one of the major pilgrimage sites of Damascus. The Umayyad Mosque, also known as the Great Mosque of Damascus, is one of the main tourist attractions of Damascus. Parts of this mosque date back 1,400 years. The mosque was built on the site of a Christian basilica, which was the burial ground of John the Baptist. With the construction of the mosque, the burial site of John the Baptist was included inside the building, and Shia Muslims, Sunni Muslims, and Christian pilgrims visited. In the Umayyad Mosque, there are 4 rectangular halls. One of them is dedicated to Imam Ali, but among Shias, it is known as Ra's al-Hussein. When the Karbala caravan reached Damascus with all of the decapitated heads of the martyrs and the family of the martyrs as captives, they entered the Umayyad Mosque where Yazid was. It is said that the holy head of Imam Hussein was placed where the shrine stands today, known as Ra's al-Hussein. Next to it is a prayer rug and mihrab encased in a glass cubicle, which marks the place where Ali ibn Hussein Zain al-Abidin used to pray while imprisoned in the castle after the Battle of Karbala. The Sayyida Ruqayya Mosque. This mosque is found a short distance from the Umayyad Mosque and contains the grave of Ruqayya, the young daughter of Imam Hussein. After enduring the Battle of Karbala and the torturous journey to Damascus that followed it, Ruqayya reached the Umayyad Mosque. As she could not bear any longer, one night the orphaned 3-year-old dreamed of her father and woke up and cried relentlessly. She cried so hard that the soldiers informed Yazid. He ordered the guards to show her the decapitated head of her father Imam to make her quiet. And Yazid was right. The 3-year-old Ruqayya was silenced forever. This tragic and moving incident has captivated the hearts of not just Shia pilgrims, but Sunnis and Christians alike. From the very first days of war on Syria, the occupation of Damascus was the terrorists' main agenda. That is why many of the suburbs on the outskirts of the city were occupied or were ceaselessly targeted by the terrorist rockets. One of these suburbs was Deir Ayyar, which the terrorists managed to occupy. This suburb was considered as a very strategic base for them, as it was located only 5 kilometers from Damascus. It took 5 years of war to liberate Deir Ayyar. It is not too hard to guess what the terrorists did to Hazrat-e Sakineh's shrine while they occupied the area. The shrine of Sakina, the daughter of Imam Ali, was completely destroyed when Deir Ayyar was occupied by the terrorists. The occupation has razed Deir Ayyar to the ground. The town is in ruins, and the Syrian army has not yet allowed it to be open to the public to enter. And devoted Shias are awaiting the time when the Syrian government reopens the gates of Deir Ayyar and they can rebuild the shrine. For sure, the main reason pilgrims travel to Syria is to visit the shrine of Hazrat Zainab. The terrorists almost reached it. They only had 100 meters to go, but they never managed to occupy it because of the resistance forces blocked them. The resistance forces included Syrian Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims from Syria, Lebanon, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq. The Iraqi resistance forces could not bear to see the shrine empty of pilgrims, so they brought in their family members from Iraq for pilgrimage during those difficult days. And thus, the shrine of Hazrat Zainab became the central hub for the resistance forces. And the valor of the resistance in defending the shrine inspired resistance forces across Syria. Now pilgrims can visit the shrine of Hazrat Zainab in absolute safety and security.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Making one final mockery of his 2016 campaign promise to drain the swamp, Donald Trump, early on Wednesday, January 20th, quietly revoked his own executive order barring administration officials from lobbying the agencies for which they worked for 5 years after leaving government, freeing up a potential line of work for outgoing White House staff. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, A Fitting End. Hours before leaving office, Trump quietly revokes order restricting lobbying by former federal officials. Here's the details of this article. Making one final mockery of his 2016 campaign promise to drain the swamp, Donald Trump, early on Wednesday, January 20th, quietly revoked his own executive order barring administration officials from lobbying the agencies for which they worked for 5 years after leaving government, freeing up a potential line of work for outgoing White House staff. While riddled with loopholes and deficiencies, the executive order represented one of the few concrete actions Trump took during his 4 years in office to rein in the corruption that has long been a hallmark of the U.S. federal government. On the whole, Trump contributed massively to that corruption during his tenure, which one watchdog group argues was marked by self-interest, profiteering at the highest levels, and more than 3,700 conflicts of interest. Shortly after 1 a.m. on Wednesday, January 20th, following the president's last-minute flurry of pardons and commutations for well-connected political cronies, the White House issued notice of the revocation of Trump's January 2017 executive order without offering an explanation for the move. A great summary of Trump's many farcical drain-the-swamp betrayals, said Norm Eisen, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His ethics EO was already garbage. Now he's throwing even that out. The net result, his officials can now sell their services to foreign governments. That's flooding the swamp, not draining it. As Politico reported on Wednesday morning, January 20th, when Trump signed his executive order with great fanfare in 2017, he joked that some of his aides would not be able to go to work after leaving his administration. But the reversal of Trump's executive order on the final day in office would appear to give some of his staff relief after appointees have had difficulty finding jobs in a Democratic-controlled capital, Politico noted. Joe Biden is expected to institute a number of new ethics rules restricting lobbying by former federal officials and barring appointees from accepting golden parachutes from their previous employers. Lisa Gilbert, Executive Vice President of Advocacy Group Public Citizen, said in a statement on Tuesday, January 19th, that if the plan is as currently being reported, this policy goes further than we have ever seen in a presidential ethics plan. It will crack down on shadow lobbying jobs and golden parachutes intended to seat corporate insiders in government and halt the rapidly spinning revolving door, Gilbert added. Boldness is needed in this moment to restore the people's faith in government, and this policy takes a critical step in the right direction. When Trump signed his executive order with great fanfare in 2017, he joked that some of his aides would not be able to go to work after leaving his administration. But the reversal of Trump's executive order on the final day in office would appear to give some of his staff relief after appointees have had difficulty finding jobs. The White House did not offer any justification for the reversal in the executive order released to the public. In the final days of his presidency, Bill Clinton similarly revoked his executive order, banning his appointees from getting into the influence game for 5 years. Joe Biden is reported to have plans to issue his own executive order, tackling ethics standards at the White House. His plan, according to the Washington Post, is expected to be more strict than the ethics rule put in place during the Trump and Obama administrations.
Midstream.
As if it was not enough for Yemenis to suffer the unjustified murderous Saudi war and blockade against them for the past 6 years, along came Trump using his last few remaining days in office to make things even worse. U.S. President Donald Trump's move to designate Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization will not only disrupt peace efforts to reach a nationwide ceasefire, but also will hamper the delivery of life-saving aid in a country where fears of famine are rising thanks to Mohammed bin Salman's aerial, sea, and land blockade. Fears have grown that such a designation, which takes effect on January 19, could put both aid groups and commercial providers at risk of American legal penalties for engagement with Ansarullah, who control large swaths of Yemen, including major points of entry. Instead of responding to the drastic need for increased funding of humanitarian aid to Yemen, the Arab world's poorest country, where 80% of the population of roughly 30 million is in need of outside assistance, in large part because of Mohammed bin Salman's game of war, Trump issued a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people in Yemen. The war has lately turned into a disastrous quagmire for Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, especially after the ground victories of Ansarullah in the northern Ma'rib governorate of Yemen. Now, with this designation, the prospects for a political settlement became remote, which, if not reversed, will prove to be a self-induced headache for Mohammed bin Salman. The designation takes effect a day before the inauguration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. While he had already promised to undo or reverse many of the current administration's foreign policy actions, Biden's intentions regarding the Ansarullah designation are still unclear. However, if he takes his time in looking into this matter when taking office, it could spell death for millions of innocent Yemenis. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman.
We'll be right back.
his last days as U.S. president, Donald Trump moved to designate Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization in no apparent reason except to disrupt peace efforts in the war-torn country. This move hinders the United Nations' efforts in restarting political talks to end the Saudi-led war on Yemen. The most serious implication for this designation is the legal impediments it could create for including Ansarullah in any future talks. To discuss this issue with us from Sydney is Jay Therapel, member of the Yemen Solidarity Council. Thank you for being with us, Jay. Now, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced on January 10th that the State Department will notify Congress that it has an intention to designate Ansarullah as a foreign terrorist organization. But when on earth did Ansarullah ever engage with the U.S. or even threaten U.S. interests anywhere?
Never. Ansarullah does not have a global agenda. They are a national resistance movement with an ideology that draws on Arab nationalism, and the ranks of their movement are comprised entirely of Yemenis. Meanwhile, according to the United States, Al-Qaeda and ISIS do have a global agenda. They have attacked the United States, and yet in Yemen, the U.S. is on the same side as Al-Qaeda, which they admitted 2 years ago, which is why the Associated Press wrote an article that admitted that Al-Qaeda militants are effectively on the same side as the United States. That's a direct quote. The fact is that there are many in the U.S. military that favor the Ansarullah movement in Yemen, but their voices have been completely sidelined. Again, these are not my views. These are the views of people who are close to the U.S. military. So to quote Michael Horton from 2015, many officials at the U.S. Special Operations Command, quote, favor the Houthis as they have been successful in rolling back Al-Qaeda. Horton then asked the question, why are we fighting a movement that's fighting Al-Qaeda? Now, these are good questions, and they're not coming from Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi. They're coming from those closest to the U.S. military. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there is widespread ignorance in the West about Islamic movements and this tendency to assume that they're all the same simply because they have guns and they scream Allahu Akbar. I mean, we have to differentiate between globalists and nationalists among Islamic movements around the world. I mean, on the one hand, you have Al-Qaeda. It's a globalist militia. It draws on recruits from all over the world. And then you have Ansarullah. They're a nationalist movement, and they're comprised entirely of Yemenis. Their interests are confined to Yemen and the Arab world. So to answer your question, they pose no threat to the U.S. whatsoever.
Well, if only the Americans knew that Allahu Akbar literally means hallelujah. But the U.S. blacklisting follows a series of victories of Ansarullah, especially in the northern part of Yemen in Ma'arib province. I mean, the Saudi-led coalition has lost a lot of land. They actually lost everything in the north. Do you think that this step will affect the performance of Ansarullah militarily?
Ansarullah is the most resilient national resistance movement in the world. I mean, so much punishment has been inflicted upon them, and yet they keep taking back territories, as you mentioned, and defeating the Saudi-backed mercenaries. Having said that, the U.S. blacklisting will certainly hurt Ansarullah by punishing its base of support in those parts of Yemen that it controls, which includes roughly 80% of Yemen's population, and that appears to be the intention. So I think if Mike Pompeo were truly honest, he'd respond by saying, yes, that is the point. U.S. officials have warned that this designation, quote, will be a death, sorry, not U.S. officials, UN officials have said mm-hmm. this, they've said that this designation will be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people. Sure. 29 aid agencies have written to the U.S. Congress expressing their concerns about this designation. And in their letter, they point out that Ansarullah are not some niche armed group with small amounts of control. They have control over one-third of Yemen's territory, where 80% of Yemen's population live. They are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. And that's going to be hamstrung because of these designations. And therefore, this entire war is about punishing the people of Yemen for rejecting a puppet government. Everything that comes out of Pompeo's mouth makes sense only in that context.
Well, the material support restrictions which you spoke about could create serious obstacles for outside mediators, especially those who are involved in the peace process, the ongoing attempt of peace talks between Ansarullah and other parties by making those parties involved, maybe making them face criminal offense to provide maybe any property or even any services to anyone affiliated even with Ansarullah, including here we're talking about expert advice and assistance. Now, is this maybe the end, in your opinion, is it the end of any possible future peace talks between Yemen and anyone else?
Not so much, and that's because peace talks are still possible. They're still possible because according to the U.S. State Department, there are prescribed terrorist organizations on both sides now, regardless of whether you agree with them. So if an outside mediator objects to Ansarullah on the grounds that the U.S. considers them to be terrorists, then they're only aiding the so-called Hadi government, which recruits directly from Al-Qaeda, which is also prescribed by the U.S. as a terrorist organization. And on top of that, Saudi Arabia supports the so-called Hadi government, which includes the Islam Party, which the Saudis themselves consider a terrorist organization because it's a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. So when you have people accusing their allies of being terrorists, why should an outside mediator take the label seriously, especially when it's coming from an outgoing administration? Furthermore, this designation speaks volumes about the divisions between. On the one hand, you have the UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council, and on the other hand, you have the Saudi-backed Hadi government, which I talked about on your show the last time I was here.
Yeah.
Your audience would be interested to know that Pompeo issued his statement declaring Ansarullah a terrorist organization on January the 10th, which he justified by claiming that Ansarullah was responsible for the attacks carried out at Aden Airport on December 30th.
Exactly.
Now, no evidence has been presented suggesting that Ansarullah was involved. The deputy foreign minister of the Ansarullah-backed government in Sana'a, his name's Hossein Al-Ezzi, he condemned the attack and he blamed it on both the UAE and Saudi Arabia. On top of that, Saudi-backed and UAE-backed forces in Yemen are accusing each other of being responsible for the attacks on Aden Airport. The Southern Transitional Council has accused the Islam Party within the Hadi government of being behind the attacks. And I've seen reports from two pro-Hadi newspapers in Aden that are accusing the UAE's military attaché of being involved in the attacks. And there have been sources from within the Aden airport staff accusing the Southern Transitional Council of confiscating the airport surveillance hardware. So my broader point is that in Aden, where the attacks happened, the accusations are flying between the Hadi government, the so-called Hadi government, and the Southern Transitional Council. But to the international media, on the same day that the attack took place, the Hadi government foreign minister blamed Ansarullah without providing any evidence, and therefore any investigation that has taken place without any evidence, and that is before any investigation had taken place. So even the former media advisor to the Hadi government, his name's Anis Mansour,
mm-hmm.
He accused both the UAE and Saudi Arabia of erasing the crime scene before any investigations could be carried out. 10 days later, Mike Pompeo justified blacklisting Ansarullah on the grounds that they were responsible for these attacks. In other words, it's entirely possible that this attack was staged to justify blacklisting the Ansarullah movement. So
just 9 days before, yep, Pompeo hits the street.
Yeah, that's right. And it's an outgoing administration.
Well, basically, so instead of actually bringing peace to this war-torn country, the U.S. just broke off any back-channel talks between Yemen and Saudi Arabia, for that matter, if it were to happen, to reach a nationwide ceasefire. If the U.S.'s move was aimed at pushing Ansarullah away from what they call is the Iranian influence or the Iranian axis, what do you think will happen now?
Well, let's judge what the U.S. is thinking by the consequences of their actions. Every ship that delivers anything to Yemen is already extensively searched for weapons, and they're specifically looking for Iranian weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's the possibility that aid agencies could be prosecuted by the U.S. government for simply sending aid to the starving people of Yemen, simply because the government in Sana'a is aligned with Ansarullah.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the only logical conclusion to be drawn from the blacklisting of Ansarullah is that the only strategy that the U.S.-Saudi alliance have is the weaponization of mass starvation against the Yemeni people. But as I mentioned earlier, the U.S. is allied with Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which perhaps explains why 2 days after blacklisting Ansarullah, Pompeo announced that Iran and al-Qaeda had formed this so-called
axis. He's just
axis.
Throwing accusations left and right.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, what you're saying is just 101 colonialism, and I wish we had more time, but I promise that we will talk more about this in upcoming episodes. I want to thank you very much, Jay Therapel, member of the Yemen Solidarity Council, for joining us from Sydney at such a late hour. I want to thank you very much, Jay, and now please stay tuned because we will keep talking about this, especially about the humanitarian crisis in Yemen in the upcoming segment.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
National human rights bodies have warned last week about how the Trump administration's designation of the Ansarullah group in Yemen as a foreign terrorist organization would threaten humanitarian aid on which millions of Yemenis rely for survival. As if the current death toll wasn't enough with such designation, the U.S. will just risk complicity in hundreds of thousands of preventable civilian deaths inside of Yemen. The world's worst humanitarian crisis in this following report. International community lawmakers, along with several government officials across the world, have denounced a rushed decision by the outgoing U.S. administration to designate Yemen's Ansarullah movement a foreign terrorist organization, emphasizing that the move will exacerbate the humanitarian crisis in the war-torn state. On January 10, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo defied warnings from humanitarian groups and announced the blacklisting of Ansarullah. The designation is set to come into force on January 19, the eve of the inauguration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden, whose aides had previously hoped to mount a fresh push to end the U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen. Trump's decision will freeze any U.S.-related assets of Ansarullah, despite the latter having nothing of that sort on U.S. soil. It will also ban American citizens from doing business with them and makes it a crime to provide support or resources to the movement, even if it were humanitarian support. Warning that Yemen could be consumed by a large-scale famine, top relief officials at the United Nations implored the United States last week to scrap its blacklisting of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, arguing that the move could effectively severe food deliveries in a country where millions already face the threat of starvation due to Saudi Arabia's inhumane blockade. Aid agencies worry their work would be criminalized. Ansarullah are the legitimate elected authority in the north, and humanitarian organizations have to get permits to carry out aid programs, as well as work with ministries and local financial systems. The designation, with the increased burdens on banks' compliance mechanisms, could also impact Yemenis' access to financial systems and remittances from abroad, as well as complicating imports and raising goods prices further. The almost six-year Saudi-led war on Yemen has left 80% of the population reliant on aid and millions on the verge of starvation. With a funding shortage this year, the United Nations had already warned that Yemen is facing what could be the world's biggest famine in decades. And what does the United States of America choose to do for that matter? Unsurprisingly, sentence millions of Yemenis to death by starvation by blacklisting the largest political bloc in the country. Now to discuss the effects of this designation with us from Malmo is Mr. Firas Ali, who is a political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Firas. Now, Yemenis, they're not going hungry. They are being starved here. Such designation would lead to exacerbating an already shocking level of hunger in Yemen because, hint, Ansarullah are Yemenis. They are residing in Yemeni cities and villages. Hence, international aid in the form of both food and medicine will be banned from getting into those areas. What options do you think now Yemenis have left in the event Trump actually goes on and bans any form of aid to go to these Yemenis?
Well, this ban will probably further worsen the humanitarian situation in Yemen if it goes into effect. And it comes at a time when Yemen is facing war, starvation, and the coronavirus. The ban will also further expose the subhuman nature of the American administration. Nevertheless, I think the Yemeni people has no other option than to resist the U.S.-Saudi war. And if they restrain themselves from further escalation for the moment being, then with this ban going into effect, the reason for restraining themselves will decline. The Yemeni people is a strong and proud people that won't let this ban to drag them down. What the war has not accomplished for 6 years, the ban won't do either. Of course, the suffering will increase, but again, they're facing a barbaric and inhuman war by cold-hearted leaders, so what to expect?
Well, Firas, fears have grown that such a designation, which takes effect on January 19, that's just one day before Trump leaves office. That's how evil that human is. So this designation would put both aid groups and commercial providers at risk of American legal penalties for simply engaging with Ansarullah or even anyone affiliated with them. They also, we need to remind that they control large swaths of Yemen. We're not talking about the small group, we're talking about more than 80% of the population. I mean, what prevents the international community here from identifying this form of ban as illegal and simply ignore it?
Well, one obstacle is the international financial system, which one way or other is connected to the U.S. dollar and to the U.S. financial system. And therefore, the U.S. sanctions have a huge effect on that system. The other problem is that these international organizations and the Western international community don't dare to challenge and defy U.S. sanctions. I mean, look at the U.N. The U.N. is incapable of doing anything against the U.S. It couldn't even stop the war on Iraq, so I don't expect them to do anything about this issue either. Even if one single individual in this international Western community disagrees, they don't dare to do anything. That's if they have or sit in a position to do anything, other than maybe uttering some useless words, because their jobs and personal life are Americanized, especially in the Western world. Their economy in their home country are dependent on U.S. financial system, and that could cause harm to their personal economy, which could be targeted, and thus they're not ready to take that step. And that's regard individuals and not Western government, who simply always mimic U.S. politics, despite what they show in openly. Look at the American withdrawal from the JCPO, for example. Despite portraying an open disagreement with Trump, in reality, they didn't do any business with Iran. I'm referring to the European governments. So international institutions and Western countries don't even dare condemning acts of terror like the assassination of Iranian scientists back in November. So I don't expect so much from them, actually.
Well, the designation takes effect, as we said, a day before the inauguration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. While he promised before to undo or at least reverse many of the current administration's foreign policy actions, but Biden's intentions regarding the Ansarullah designation are still very vague. They're not clear. Do you think that the humanitarian situation in Yemen could be maybe an enough drive for Biden to do something about it, to change, reverse, even at least stop the support for Saudi Arabia?
Well, Marwa, firstly, we have to remember that the war on Yemen started during Biden's watch as a vice president.
Exactly.
It was the Obama It was the Obama administration that gave green light and support for the war from day one. So Biden doesn't have a clean record when it comes to the war in Yemen. But again, Biden wants to portray himself as opposite to Trump, and his time in office as a president could be a good excuse to stop the war, because the Saudis will never win.